Okay, on the record here, I'm not sure how long this is going to take today, but I'm on a soft standby to pick up my grandson at school at 3 and take him to his violin lesson. My daughter's got a sick kid at home, but if that doesn't work out, it's fine. I got a backup. So, anyway, my name is Pat Ward. I'm an administrative law judge pursuant to temporary appointment designated by the Office of Administrative Hearings at the request of the Public Service Commission to serve as procedural hearing officer for this consolidated hearing. This is the hearing on the application of NSP for an ADP regarding several wind projects in North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, and Iowa. PU-17-120 relates to 1550 megawatts of wind generation. PU-372 relates to another 302.4 megawatts of wind generation. This is North Dakota Public Service Commission consolidated case PU-17-120 and PU-17-372. I understand there's been a settlement of these matters between NSP and staff to be presented to the commissioners for consideration and review today. The issue to be considered in all these matters is whether each of NSP's proposed resource additions is prudent. The record will show it is a little past 9 a.m., October 11, 2018, at the commission hearing room, 12th floor, State Capitol, Bismarck, North Dakota, the time, date, and place set by the notice of rescheduled consolidated hearing. Mr. Simpson, would you please state your appearance for the record and the appearance of anyone at council table?
Zev Simpson, Briggs & Morgan, on behalf of Northern States Power Company. With me is Ryan Long, XL Energy Services, also on behalf of Northern States Power Company.
Thank you. Mr. Armstrong.
Mitch Armstrong, Special Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of advocacy staff. With me is Victor Shook, also with advocacy staff.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
Ilana Jeffcoat-Sacco, General Counsel, on behalf of the Public Service Commission.
Okay, and I understand that the exhibits have been marked and there is a stipulation to the exhibits?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and we are talking exhibits NSP 1 through 27 and exhibit PSC 1 through 8. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And they are all agreed to admission and stipulated?
Yes.
Okay, then those exhibits will be admitted. Council want to make any opening statements or opening remarks?
No, Your Honor. We'll reserve that for our witnesses.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No, thank you.
Okay. If there's anyone present other than witnesses for the company, raise your hand. Yes. Are you here to testify today?
No.
Okay. All right. Then we'll move along and have opening comments from the commissioners. Who wants to start? Chairman Christman, you want to start with the opening comments today?
I do not have any opening comments.
Thank you, Your Honor. I do not have any opening comments. I'm ready to start the testimony.
Commissioner Fedorchik.
I also will withhold any opening comments.
Mr. Crocious.
No comments.
Okay. Everybody wants to get me to that violin lesson. Okay. You can go ahead and call your first witness, Mr. Simpson.
Thanks, Your Honor. The company calls Akash Chandran to the stand.
Mr. Chandran, you've been here before, but I'm for the record, I'm going to advise you of the law regarding perjury in this state. Perjury is a false statement under oath of a material fact made by a person who knows or does not believe the statement to be true at the time it is made. Perjury is a Class C felony. A Class C felony is subject to a maximum penalty of 5 years in prison or a fine of $10,000 or both. Having been advised of this penalty, please raise your right hand so I can administer an oath. Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Thank you. Mr. Simpson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chandrana, good morning.
Good morning.
Your pre-filed written testimony has been stipulated and entered into the record in this case, and I understand you have an opening statement.
I do. Good morning, Commissioners Crocious, Crisman, and Fedorchik. My name is Akash Chandrana, and I am the Regional Vice President for XL Energy. I am here today to provide testimony supporting the settlement agreement between XL Energy and advocacy staff granting advanced determinations of prudence with conditions for the company's 1850 megawatt of wind projects. Overall, the company's 1850 megawatt of wind additions is a large portfolio of projects, but they are prudent. With wind pricing the lowest we have seen yet, the ability to capture production tax credits before they are fully phased out, and our ability to leverage large supplier relationships have allowed us to secure pricing for each of these projects that, in aggregate, will likely lower system costs by over $1 billion during the lives of the projects. For no other reason than the cost savings, these projects are prudent. Advisory staff and their consultant recognize the prudence of capturing the cost savings for our North Dakota customers, but in negotiations requested conditions to ensure that these benefits are actually captured. Therefore, Xcel Energy has agreed to conditions in the settlement agreement that, among other things, generally cap the capital costs of our projects to mitigate cost uncertainty and require the company to insulate customers should the production tax credits, for whatever reason, not be available for the projects. Recognizing the advantages for customers of our wind additions and the reasonableness of staff's interest in protecting customers in a reasonable way, the company has agreed to these conditions. Therefore, I ask that the Commission approve the settlement agreement today. I look forward to answering your questions regarding these important projects. Thank you.
The witness is available for cross.
Mr. Armstrong.
No questions.
Ms. Jeff Kotsako.
Can you just tell me in a very simple statement the difference in savings between the original proposal, if any, and the post, you know, the supplemental proposal?
Yep. I believe in our supplemental filing, our supplemental application, so I'll just look for the exhibit number really quickly. I believe 22.
21.
I thought it was 21. Yep, 21. I think we explained that initially, prior to the tax reform bill being passed, it was about $1.6 billion across the system, and that declined to $1.4 billion across the system. And I can.
And that means what to the North Dakota ratepayers?
Just give me 1 second. I will just go ahead and tell you that number.
I have a couple numbers in my head, but I'm not sure they're right. So
yeah. On page 2 of Exhibit 21, we explain in the first full paragraph that at $1.4 billion system-wide, that would result in about $75 million of savings for North Dakota customers compared to $85 million for North Dakota customers pre-tax reform.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I did have one other question here from Jerry, who isn't here, but we talked about it yesterday. Can you explain the reporting of curtailment and negative pricing information that the settlement requests or that you've committed to in the settlement?
Sure.
Explain why that's appropriate.
Why it's appropriate.
Appropriate or necessary.
Oh, sure. And let me just make sure that I from my perspective, the reason why this would be important is really goes to understanding the overall economics of the savings that the projects would deliver. So we use models to make a determination and assessment of what the economic values would be. And with that, we make certain assumptions in terms of how much wind is going to get produced. And so reporting upon that, as well as what actual pricing is at which that the wind clears, will make sure that there's some symmetry or at least understanding of what we projected to be the savings and what the actual savings are understood.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it. That's all I have.
Hey, commissioners. Mr. Crocious.
Well, good morning. First question is, I want to go back to the $1.4 billion number in terms of total savings and the $85 million that moved to $75 million for North Dakota customers.
Okay.
The original settlement landed at $1.4 billion, And I believe that was on September 22nd, 2017.
Yes.
Then work began after that on the Tax Cut and Jobs Act.
Mm-hmm.
And this settlement is $1.4 billion. You had mentioned a $200 million difference, but it didn't change from the $1.4 billion from the first settlement to the current settlement. And the Tax Cut and Jobs Act was in the middle of both of those. So why didn't it drop to 1.2 if there's a $200 million savings?
Commissioner Crosius, I think one of the biggest changes in terms of timing, at least between when we entered the first settlement and now, is that we've added another project. So the first settlement that was in place was for the original wind portfolio of 1,550 megawatts, and then the second settlement now includes the Dakota Range project, which adds another 302 megawatts. So that's the reason why we're not seeing a step down the way that you would expect it to be seen.
And Dakota Range is $167 million in system savings overall, $9 million for North Dakota?
I believe that's correct.
And those savings are with factoring in wind-induced coal cycling, congestion costs, future infrastructure needs, and the PTC.
That's correct.
First settlement's not in there. Would these projects be feasible from a cost savings standpoint or justified from a cost savings standpoint without the PTC?
Yes, Commissioner Crosius. Thank you.
Can you share what that number might be?
Yes, I believe, Commissioner Crosius, that the savings that we would see if there were no PTCs would be roughly half to what we're projecting, about 50% or so. Might be a little bit less than that, but that's kind of the math that I came up with.
Is that based and recalling Mr. Heidel's testimony and analysis. He was using, I believe, a 20-year figure for that. I don't think that's the same number that you were using, is it?
No. The way in which I evaluate that, and Mr. Martin can talk about this more, is to really look at the fact that the PTCs roll off the projects after 10 years. And so as you look at the savings on an annual basis and you just go through and calculate how much savings you're generating, when you get to year 10, you can see that the savings change and you see a reduced amount of savings. So you can see through there just how much the tax credits are contributing versus other aspects, such as the fact that you're displacing higher cost energy.
Now, these projections, they factor in wind-induced coal cycling, but in terms of potential early retirement, an early retirement of the facilities, that's not factored in?
No, Commissioner Crosius. When we model, and again, Mr. Martin can talk about our modeling philosophy, but I can touch upon it more from a policy basis, which is that we're taking the system as it is today and what we project the system to be today, what we know today. And so we're looking at that, and we're running our models based upon that. So we're not considering what the implications are if there's early retirements, any further early retirements of any units.
Is that a possibility? I guess anything's possible. But
anything's possible, yeah. I mean, the models are pretty flexible, and we could look at that. I think the thing to keep in mind is that all of these projects, even post-tax reform, the levelized cost of energy for these projects, which are trade secret, but I can just give you a rough estimate, they're all lower than not only the market levelized cost of energy, but also the levelized cost of energy of any of our coal units. So these would be the cheapest sources of energy on our system.
But without decommissioning costs factored in, if a plant, coal-fired plant, for example, were to retire early, mm-hmm. there would be a decommissioning cost of that facility.
There would be a, well, I want to make sure that we get our terms right here, because in terms of decommissioning a coal plant, there is part of what is accumulated or accrued in rates through something called RWIP actually factors in what is going to be the decommissioning cost. I think you might be thinking about the fact that all these plants have a book life, and there's a certain amount of depreciation that's sitting out on our books. And if you don't run the plants all the way to the end of their life, you have a certain amount of depreciation that's not yet recovered. And that term is called a stranded asset.
Right.
And so at some level, you know, if you early retire something, you have a stranded asset to consider. Typically, we don't take a new resource such as an energy-only resource and apply a stranded asset value or apply that to our modeling exercise, because these are different forms of resources. Coal plant provides energy and capacity. These projects provide energy and a very, very small amount of capacity, at least in terms of how that's dealt with in MISO. And so as we look at this, we wouldn't think of it that way. What we would think of it as is if you took those, if you took any plant and you early retired it, now you're missing a certain amount of energy and you're missing a certain amount of capacity. And what's the least cost way of bringing that forward? And in this situation, at least from an energy perspective, these are very, very inexpensive resources in providing energy.
But it could impact ratepayers down the road. Say 10 years from now, if there was an early retirement, stranded asset, X amount that hasn't been depreciated yet, that could potentially make its way back to ratepayers, correct?
And they're distinct from one another, is what I'm probably failing at articulating very clearly. They're distinct, in my mind.
Is the answer no?
So, no. I just want to make it clear that they're distinct. So if the company makes a decision to retire any unit, any generating unit, prior to it exhausting its book life, and if that book life hasn't been adjusted in rates and there's a stranded asset, and we come before this commission and say, can we please recover that stranded asset? Yes, there would be an impact on rates.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's the most common question I get. I can't assume what my colleagues here, but I would suspect it's along the same lines. We have facilities producing, you know, coal-fired plants, nuclear, whatever it might be. They're in place, and you don't need the capacity until 2025 in this case, I believe.
And that's why I'm really trying, and I'm trying not to like muddle this up too much, and I apologize if I am. Energy and capacity in our lives is just very different. And when we bring on really inexpensive energy resources, market prices go down, and that helps all customers, because all customers then get the benefit of lower fuel costs. That doesn't take away our obligation to have a minimum amount of capacity and to make sure that we have enough capacity on our system to serve our customers on the hottest days. And as great as these wind resources are, at least from MISO's perspective, We don't get a lot of capacity accreditation for these. They're not great capacity resources.
Right.
Our coal units, our nuclear units, those are really good capacity resources. And so we might have a lot of length, capacity length on our system. And we may even have a lot of energy length on our system. But our philosophy has been when there's opportunities to bring on resources that are lower than market cost from an energy perspective, and we can do so in a cost-effective way, that's going to drive a lot of benefits to all customers. And that's the reason why you're seeing numbers like $1.4 billion in overall system savings or $75 million for North Dakota customers.
Okay, I'd gone through my questions from the time before, from the previous hearing, when so a lot of those were answered. And you know, what's new would be the PTC, and then, of course, Dakota Range is new as well. I think I asked, well, I know I asked this last time, but how many jobs will this result in, and where does the workforce come from? Construction.
I'm not... I'm not sure if we included the number of jobs that this would generate, but I do know that for the projects that we are working on, because I know there's a couple of power purchase agreements in here, you know, we our philosophy is to use union labor, and so, but I don't know how many jobs exactly it's going to create during the construction period. I can find that out and get that to you.
Well, I won't run through the questions I asked the time before. And plus, I'm feeling a little bit of pressure so someone isn't stranded at school at 3 o'clock.
Those are all the all those questions were the ones that I was ready for, by the way.
That's a lot of pressure. I do miss those days.
I'm not quite to those days yet.
And Dakota Range is in South Dakota, so I don't have any other questions at this time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Christman.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning.
Good morning.
I'm going to kind of bounce around because I'm going by, I'm clarifying some things from previous testimony. So
okay.
It's kind of in order that I learned of it, not in order that to keep the subject material together.
All right.
I think we heard from witness Sarah Cardwell, and that, if I recall right, you affirmed it, that that these will be built anyway, whether you get the ADP in advance or not. Is that still the case?
That's correct.
And also, Sarah Cardwell said something to the effect that there are no benefits built into the settlement at that time, and this was a year and a couple weeks ago, that we could not realize in a rate case later. Would you respond to that at now in 2018?
Any benefits that you wouldn't, from a rate-making perspective, that's correct.
There's still no immediate need for capacity. The capacity need is in approximately 2025. Is that correct?
That's correct.
MISO is responsible for the integration, correct?
MISO is responsible for managing and administering the interconnection process. And so if that's what we're trying to get to, that's correct.
Mr. Heidel said, by the way, are you expected to be the sole witness? I don't know if these should be divided up.
Mr. Martin will also be testifying. Look at me. I just switched into my old lawyer days there. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, yeah. Mr. Martin is available to testify on many of these very detailed questions and with respect to modeling.
Okay. So if any of these are for the wrong person, just let me know.
Yeah. Or I'll just do my best and then have him clean it up.
Yeah.
Which will make his life even more miserable.
Makes them nervous.
You can see him. He's kind of nervous over there. That's why I look over this way.
Somewhere along the line, I don't know if it was a direct statement or just my own notes, I have down from Mr. Heidel the belief that MISO is responsible for reliability, not state regulators. Is that your perception?
Did you say reliability?
That MISO is responsible for reliability.
For whatever reason, I heard liability, and I'm like, oh. I think that it's tricky because, and this is my own personal belief, so just bear with me here. I mean, MISO and the federal construct is responsible for reliability, and when we go back, it's probably now at least 15 plus years ago when there was a really significant blackout here in the upper Midwest that actually started out in Michigan and kind of rippled its way across. I mean, there's really a belief at the federal level that we didn't want to have that anymore. And so there's a lot of elements there, both at FERC and NERC and all these other entities, of really making sure that the bulk power grid is reliable. And MISO's job is to assure that the transmission system is reliable. And that means if we're putting things onto it, being coal units or wind units or solar or whatever it may be, that is balanced with also the amount of load that's on the system and then how the power moves. And so from that perspective, I do agree with Mr. Heidel that, you know, MISO's got a responsibility to assure that the bulk power system, transmission system, operates reliably so that there aren't those types of incidences that happened 20-some years ago. That being said, the state regulators have a very important role as well, because at the end of the day, if I, as a company, I, as an organization, decide to make investments in the bulk power system, I have to come to you and ask you for permission to recover those costs through rates. And it's that juncture where you have a very important decision to make in terms of assessing whether or not that decision is prudent or not. If it's not prudent, I don't get to recover it in rates. And so I don't see it as bright of a line, but I do see it that there are boundaries and there's roles to be played in both.
Your answer seems to tell me that you see a responsibility for state regulators on rates, but your previous answer that these projects will go forward whether ADP is granted or not, tell me that as far as the any reliability impact that these and other intermittent projects around the country that are being added into the system go, that it's pretty much solely with the RTOs.
Oh, I don't.
And the companies.
Well, I'm going to push back because I don't see it exactly that way. An advanced determination of prudence tells me that I have certainty from a rate recovery perspective, and my personal perspective is that if I can make the case, if we as a company can make the case that these are prudent decisions, which $1.4 billion of cost savings would indicate that they are, then in turn we get certainty that we can recover the costs. If we haven't made our case here, we're going to come back in a rate case and we're going to present our case again. I mean, and so to me, as a state regulator, if you disagree with decisions that we're making, at some point the financial implications of those are going to, they're going to mean something to us. And so I don't view this as the RTOs and the company or utilities are just going to go off and go do things. The expectation is that we're going to make decisions that we believe are prudent. We're going to make our case. And if you disagree with that, you have a very strong posture in that. And so I don't view this as there's that we're running end round on state commissions here.
Is it fair? Would you agree that there's been a lot of advancement in efficiency of various types of energy generation in the last 7 years?
Yes, I would very much agree with you that things have gotten, as technology has advanced, things have gotten, machines have gotten better.
So would it be only logical to assume that in the next 7 years, by the time this energy is needed, that there's going to be a lot more efficiency and advancement?
And again, I'll just make the distinction, capacity in the seven-year period, and for capacity purposes, we will look to high efficiency or whatever at the time is, you know, the cheapest, makes the most sense resource, evaluating a different set of factors or a multitude of factors to address capacity needs. Yes, technology is going to continue to advance. Things are going to get better over time, and that is a fact. But what I want to stress here is, based upon what we know today, is a couple things. One, as it pertains to these wind projects, the bulk of them are eligible for 100% production tax credits. And so half the savings, as I mentioned before, are tied to that. At some point in the near future, those production tax credits are no longer going to exist. And so what happens to wind pricing at that time is as good a guess as anybody's. But the going feeling is that the prices are going to go up. So whether or not those projects, whether or not wind post-production tax credits still is the most effective from a cost perspective, from an efficiency perspective, whatever it might be, to add to our system to for energy, we'll have to make those decisions at that time. But I just want to stress that one of the reasons why we brought it forward now, instead of waiting for technology to get better and better and better and better, is we know that the pricing today is the lowest that we've ever seen. And when you know that one known variable is going to go away, the going call would say, you take it now.
Were there previous tax credits or any type of government promotions to encourage wind power before the current PTC program came into existence that were either renewed or replaced by these even more lucrative credits?
The production tax credits have remained at this clip of 100% for quite some time prior to this. The reason why we're seeing that the prices came down that the way that they did relates back to efficiency. I mean, as you go through and you look at some of the supplemental testimony, the turbines are getting better. They can produce more electricity, and as they produce more electricity, the value to customers goes up. But what we do know now post as a result of the tax bill or the tax law is that the production tax credits will phase out. And so they're going to go from 100% to 80 to 60, and they're going to be gone.
But was there a previous program from the federal government, I don't know, 10, 12, 14 years ago that ended, and this is the current PTCs are either a renewable or a replacement of that or something to that effect? Was there something else previous to this?
No, I mean, the current PTC at 100% has been around for at least, I want to say, 5 years, if not longer.
And before that, there was nothing?
I'm not aware of it. I mean, I'm not aware of anything prior to production tax credits.
Okay. You know, if the production tax credits turn out to be extended or replaced with something else similar, and technology continues to advance so that in a few years there's better, more efficient technology and something similar to PTCs, will this have turned out to be a mistake?
I don't think so. And you can look at one simple marker, which is what market prices are right now for energy. I mean, they're in the mid-20s, and you have the information in front of you. All of these projects have levelized costs of energy that are significantly below the market. I also think that we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that if PTCs or some other thing comes down the road, it presents an opportunity as well. There's nothing that there's an opportunity there that we or a third-party developer or anyone can take that when that comes up and repower these facilities and make use of the site, make use of the land again, make use of maybe the tower, put new turbines on, and take advantage of those efficiencies. And in fact, there are developers that are off doing that very thing right now. They're taking 10-year-old sites, 10-year-old wind farms, and they're saying, you know what, I have 100% PTC wind turbines. I'm going to repower my units. I'm going to repower this wind farm. It's going to increase the amount of energy. It's going to drive savings, and I'm going to take advantage of that.
Did the biomass projects seem like good investments at the time when they were made?
Again, it's a well put point, and I hate to hide behind the law, but I guess I will, which is, at least in terms of the biomass facilities, we were required by law to go off and go build those and go put those facilities into service. We're not under any legal requirement to do this.
But according to Mr. Heidel's testimony that was filed or dated August 20th, with this, the resource balance is heavily tilted toward renewables compared to expected MISO distribution, but consistent with Minnesota requirement, which kind of sounds to me like a way of saying that this is being done to meet Minnesota requirements, just like the biomass projects were.
Yeah, and again, I'm going to push back because this wind portfolio is part of and is one component of Xcel Energy, not NSP, Xcel Energy's investment into wind that went across all 8 states. And so if you go look at Colorado, if you go look at New Mexico and Texas, we brought wind forward in every one of those states, all roughly at the same time. Every one of the projects that we brought forward was justified first and foremost on economics, not any other basis. These are really cheap resources. I don't need these resources for meeting any Minnesota compliance requirements. I've met that for a long time.
Why do you suppose the other MISO participants aren't elevating their wind portfolios to the same level? Because that's what I take out of this statement, that they're not, when he says it's heavily tilted toward renewables compared to expected MISO distribution.
Yeah, and that's probably a question best for Mr. Heidel, because I don't know if he looked at all of MISO or if he looked at Zone 1. And if you look at Zone 1, which is the zone that we're in, we are the largest utility in that space. And so I would just say that our other utility brethren are doing wind projects, but they're not going to do it at the same scale that we're going to do it because they're not of the same size as we are.
Okay, you mentioned things that were looked at and weren't looked at. Now I'm going back to Mr. Heidel's testimony that was dated August 1st of last year, of 2017.
Okay.
He said the model, and I'm believing this to be your model, tends to underestimate the operations of higher cost peaking resources as well as understate the ramping and cycling operations of dispatchable resources. What's your response to that?
I'm going to say that's a good question for Mr. Martin. That's a pretty in the weeds model question, so I will only make life harder for him if I try to answer that question.
Okay. And then continuing on with what things have been looked at and haven't been looked at, and so maybe you'll have the same response, but it's not the model, I don't believe. In looking at the trade secret protected version.
Okay.
It seems to me that the Blazing Star 1 and 2 interconnection costs are extraordinarily high.
Your Honor, just to make sure that everybody's, the actual costs that we have identified are trade secret information,
and
Mr. Commissioner.
Yeah, so I don't know if I'm not seeking a number, but I'm just, is that a concern that, because somewhere along the line, I think something was mentioned that we can separate projects out of here, and those seem very high, and I'm just wondering what your response or explanation for that is.
I mean, I'm going to talk about it really in a broad basis, and then I'll leave it for Mr. Martin to actually speak to what I would say is the comparative value of the interconnection costs, which when I hear a word like high, I think that that's got to be benchmarked against something. So I'll just talk about just interconnection costs just generally.
And my only benchmark was the others.
And I think Mr. Martin can speak to that with a little bit more clarity than I can, at least in terms of assessing the projects. I mean, one of the things that was very important to us was where in the MISO interconnection process all of these different facilities were. And so many of them were in places in terms of the MISO interconnection process where we knew that there would be some firmness in terms of understanding the interconnection costs. And that was important for us, and also that they could be interconnected, consistent with achieving the 100% PTCs. And so to the extent that an interconnection cost may be higher than others, it might just be, well, due to the fact that there might be more congestion on that particular interconnection point, that there might need to be more upgrades associated with that. But we factored all of those pieces in as part of understanding the cost-benefit analysis. So I'll leave it at that, because if I go too much further, he'll have a lot of cleanup to do, but I think I left him in an okay place there.
So, but the more detailed questions on that subject should be for Mr. Martin anyway?
I would say so.
Okay, then I'll just save you the trouble on a couple of these. MISO's aware of all these projects, and you're in the queue, or you're approved, or what's the status regarding MISO's role in integrating all this energy?
So, back when I was a lawyer, I used to do a lot of this. So I'm going to try to not get too far into the weeds because I might get too excited. There's a process that MISO generator interconnection process, a GIP, which every generator has to submit an interconnection request to MISO. They get assigned a queue number, and then they go through the process of then being interconnected. And what that means is that they actually get studied, and once their study process is complete, they negotiate what's called a generator interconnection agreement. And that generator interconnection agreement is a three-party agreement between the generator, MISO, and the transmission operator, which sometimes is us, Xcel Energy. And that agreement lays out the terms of interconnection and lays out any costs that the generator has to pay for or any costs that are going to be socialized in order to interconnect that generator, all consistent with MISO's tariff.
And so all these eight projects are in the queue and approved?
All of these eight projects are in the queue. Mr. Martin will know if all eight have completed the study process. My understanding is that most of them have. And after they've completed the study process, you enter into a generator interconnection agreement.
So is there any way that there is a concern that Xcel is doing these projects, and Company B is doing some projects, and Company C is doing some projects, and everybody races out in a clear effort to mine production tax credits while the mining is good. Mm-hmm. And we get past 2020, and there's so much intermittent power has been added that they can't maintain reliability? Or is that queue system, for lack of a better term, weeding out projects so that it will be a manageable amount only that is built?
The queue process underwent a pretty significant reform. I want to say it was maybe, let's just say, 7 to 8 years ago. And as part of the queue reform process, one of the things that MISO did is that they went away from studying projects in isolation to studying projects in clusters. And so they take a group of projects and they put them together and they study them as part of a portfolio of projects to very much understand the very issue that you're getting at, which is what happens if you put an entire portfolio of projects, not just these, but, you know, let's say 3,000 megawatts of wind. Let's study all of that and see what happens to the system. And let's identify the interconnection costs associated with that and then make sure that this portfolio of projects is paying for those costs, not some other way. And as a result of that, some projects drop out because they sit there and go, I can't afford that. And some projects say, you know what, that's pretty consistent with what I thought was going to happen. And so they move forward. So that's how that process is generally managed. So to answer your question, they are thinking of these things so that when all of this is done, we're not left then with a bulk transmission system that is unreliable.
This next one is borderline what I thought I was leaving for the next witness.
Okay.
But I don't want to get there. I don't want to get there, and then it turns out that this is based on what you just said.
I promise I won't leave.
More for
so
you.
You can bring me back.
So you said that these are going to be built regardless what we do here. They're going to be built in the pretty near future.
Yes.
And unless there was something that's been added or that I didn't understand, two of them didn't even have interconnection costs filed. So it's unknown. So what if it's extraordinarily high? You're just going to build it anyway? And because come hell or high water, we've got to mine these PTCs, and whatever the costs turn out to be, they'll be?
No. And
that is how we got into the biomass projects, I expect. I wasn't here then, but
And I'll just keep it on these particular projects. There's a lot of hard work that goes into the contracts associated with all of these projects, and there's contracts with every one of these. And the contracts allow the company to walk away from the projects if certain things happen. And with some of the contracts, interconnection costs were a very key negotiating provision because we didn't want to take on that risk that all of a sudden studies come back and we thought the interconnection costs were going to be $5 and it turned out that they were $500. And that's how we protected not only ourselves but our customers, is to allow ourselves to walk away from the projects without any penalty, without any harm, without having to build the projects if those types of outcomes materialized.
But dirt hasn't been turned yet, has it?
Well, on some of these projects, they have been because they've got 19 in-service dates. So,
Was it because dirt was turned or because 5% of the costs have been incurred?
I'm missing something now.
Well, my understanding is there's a couple ways to lock in a year of percentage is going to be.
Yep.
And one of them is by starting construction.
We did not.
And the second is by incurring, I think it was 5% of the costs.
Yep.
And so if that 5% or more of the costs have already been incurred, and then you first find out what the interconnection costs are, is that money lost then or?
No. The way in which we secured the PTCs largely was through a master agreement with Vestas. And again, the reason why I stress that this is part of a larger Xcel Energy portfolio is that's how we were able to get such great pricing on the turbines. And part of the way that we were able to lock into the 100% PTCs was to enter into an arrangement with Vestas.
Your Honor, I just want to remind the witness he's veering into some trade secret testimony.
Thank you.
Okay. I really don't know how to answer that question then.
Okay.
Other than to tell you it wasn't through Turning Dirt.
Sorry.
You don't have to apologize to me. Thank you.
And, of course, Commissioner, we can always close the hearing if we want to go into trade secret information.
I'll reevaluate it after the second witness is done. I have no other questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Judge, I'd be happy to wait until after break if you feel the need, but I'm also happy to go forward.
Hey, I don't think we need
to break yet. Okay, just following up on a few of Commissioner Christman's and questions and Commissioner Crosher's and some of my own. So since we've been talking about the MISO queue, I've seen the maps of the MISO queue and the charts, and I've been in enough presentations where I've heard people say that there's no room for a lot of the proposed projects in Zone 1 with the system the way it is today without additional new high-voltage lines being constructed. So do these projects fall into that category, or are these projects in the category of we've already accounted for and have space for these, it's all these extra ones out here that are not going to be able to find their way until we do another, you know, big portfolio of high voltage lines?
Yeah, really good question. And the reason why we locked into this portfolio of projects and is because they fit into your left-hand camp, which was the camp of these projects got in early enough into the queue process that there is enough transmission capacity available to interconnect them reliably, subject to making the necessary upgrades that have to be made or incurring the necessary cost to interconnect them.
Okay. And if you decide or if the interconnection is higher than anticipated or calculated, is that part of the cost cap protection that is already outlined in the settlement agreement, where we say that, you know, up to this specific cost, these are prudent, and anything above that, you'll have to come back and justify? So we're protected if the interconnection costs are higher than what you've already anticipated or calculated into this.
That's correct, Commissioner Fedorchak. So that was a pretty critical piece of the settlement in terms of staff's perspective. And to be transparent, this is something that we've done across the Minnesota side as well, which is to put a cap in place and commit that we won't spend above those dollars.
Okay. And the transmission costs, so any of the upgrades that you know are going to be required for interconnect, those are included already and considered into the whole cost versus how much we're saving.
Correct.
Okay. Let's see. Just going to look through here to see if I can have a order to the rest of this. You've had some questions back and forth with Brian and Randy about the capacity versus need issue.
Sorry.
This is just a straight out, we don't need any of this, but we can stop running or entering into the market higher cost resources and put in these lower cost resources. And even after we pay for the cost of all these new resources, we're still going to save $85 million or whatever the cost is for North Dakota.
75.
So how... That's just strictly on a use basis, right? Like you're running it, you know you don't need it, but you're going to displace higher cost resources.
That's correct. So, I'm not going to get into the how we put projects into, how we bid projects in and how that all works. It's just more that when you've got resources that are this when the price, the levelized cost of these projects are so much lower than what the market is, there's a delta there, and because these are going to run, your overall fuel costs are going to go down, your energy costs are going to go down. Other things that are more expensive are not going to run as much.
So the one thing, the one key line that you just said is because these are going to run. And you can only achieve the savings if they are running.
Correct.
So how does your model, without getting too into the weeds, how does your model account for or calculate whether there is going to be room in the market for these to run?
So the model, without getting too far into it, and Mr. Martin can talk about this a bit more, is there's a sensitivity in the model which allows you to either turn the markets off or turn the markets on. And oftentimes what we do is turn the markets on. So you see the interaction and the interplay of what these resources do in light of being part of a larger marketplace. And in this situation, we had the markets on, and that helped drive some of the benefits, is because these resources can be sold into the market, and that generates revenue. And that revenue is then shared back as a credit to customers. And so that's how we
do that.
That's how we do that.
But is it the market as it stands today without factoring in other additions that might be coming to play and having to compete with those? How do you even begin to estimate that?
I'll just briefly touch upon this, and then Mr. Martin can go a little bit further, which is that there's sensitivities that you can put into the marketplace. So you can have a sensitivity for what do we think market prices are going to do over time? What do we think gas prices are going to do over time? And those are the things that Mr. Heidel looked at, and those are the things that Mr. Martin looked at.
Okay. And does it have sensitivities for congestion, like a bunch of other wind projects coming onto the market at the same time trying to compete for the transmission wires and for the demand that it might exist on the system at any given time?
You know, I'm probably going to let PJ answer that question because I'm just now stepping into a place where I'm not 100% confident.
Hopefully I'll be able to phrase that again in a way that is understandable. Remember that, please.
Zeb's taking scrupulous
notes
there. All right.
And they'll probably make sure.
Because that's, I mean, to me, this is a no-brainer if you're just looking at the cost savings. How can you not say it's prudent?
Right.
But it's only prudent if you can actually achieve those cost savings. Otherwise, you could end up with a bunch of, because you can actually produce and sell in the market, you could end up with a bunch of wind farms out there that are stranded that can't sell into the market because there's no room for them. There's so much power available that it's not needed.
I could see how you could arrive at that point, but I think there's two layers here. One is, let's go back to the production tax credits and how much they're kicking into this, and that's a production-based tax credit.
Mm-hmm.
So long as we are being prudent in how we own and operate and maintain the facilities, meaning that they're running, and we've got lots and lots of safeguards that we've gone through the effort of putting into place to make sure that happens, you're going to get a chunk of savings just from that, which is the production tax credits.
As long as they're producing.
As long as they're producing. But don't forget, you have a pretty big stick over us at that point, right? I mean, if they're not producing, and I come back in here and I say, I need to recover these operation and maintenance costs associated with these wind facilities. You're like, no, I don't want you to recover those. You guys are doing a horrible job out there. So I don't want to get sidetracked.
We don't want that to happen.
Neither do we, because it's bad for us. It's a black mark for us. And we're depriving our customers of the benefits associated with these projects then. And the other side of the wind portfolio is associated with its really low-cost energy. And at prices at this juncture, it's going to take a lot in terms of the market to go from where it sits today to be at a place where these projects are either at parity with the market or even more expensive than market. And I think that's why, from an expert perspective, your expert who looked at this, or advocacy staff's expert perspective who looked at this through more conservative sensitivities, came to the conclusion that these projects are going to drive these benefits. It's very likely that they will.
I guess I'm not questioning coming at it from a standpoint of the costs not being competitive. I'm coming at it from a perspective of, there's going to be so much available cheap energy out there. There isn't enough demand for it all, so it won't run.
And I think from that perspective, we have to look at the scope of the MISO market and how big it is. It's a massive marketplace, and it's got seams with other marketplaces. The energy will get moved, and it will get consumed.
Okay. Moving towards a different area then. You talked a little bit about this with Commissioner Crosius. Do you have any early retirements planned?
Outside of Sherco 1 and 2? No, ma'am.
And remind me how the costs of that early retirement are being recovered or calculated, or, you know, what did you go through in calculating that? I realize it's a little unrelated to this, but since you brought it up.
You're trapped.
But you didn't prepare for that question.
Stop opening my big mouth. You're asking in terms of Sherco 1 and 2?
Generally, did we give an ADP on that? I mean, have we talked about this?
We have not talked about this yet. So,
but you do have plan on retiring those early?
We do plan on doing so, yes.
And replacing it with what?
Of this juncture, it would be more likely than not, a gas combined cycle on site.
We haven't seen that, none of this?
None of this yet.
All of that calculation for the costs, the lost depreciation, the cost of the new, all of that would come forward in ADP at the appropriate time?
Either an ADP or a rate case or something.
All right. Yes.
It's not a discussion that we can get away from. We intend on having it with you.
Okay. If the PPA price that you have, and there's only one of these that's a PPA, is it?
I really thought that there were two in
there. Okay.
But
if the PPA price is higher than the market price, the customers miss out on that savings, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And you talked a little bit about this calculation that you're going to be providing us with when you were visiting with Alana. The monthly fuel cost rider, in the monthly fuel cost riders to the commission, you provide curtailment and negative pricing information at each of the projects, et cetera. So you can get at a full analysis of the benefits.
Correct.
Do you have that analysis from previous projects? Is that analysis, or is there a comparison that you have so you know that we're somewhere in the reality with what we're anticipating now?
I'm not sure if we have something like that in the record, but I know that internally we have that because we look at that and we understand which projects are being curtailed, and we understand what LMP pricing is doing.
Is that part of your modeling in terms of projecting the cost savings? Is that baked in? Maybe.
And so I think when you talk to PJ, you can talk to him a little bit about how we contemplated curtailments and I said this before, the sensitivities around market prices. You know.
Okay. All right. What is the value of this ADP to you, and why does that, how does that find its way towards benefits to the customers, to our customers?
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a couple of benefits with the ADP, and I'll go back to it again, which is providing us certainty to understand that we are going to recover the costs associated with these projects sends us a positive feedback signal. These are prudent investments, and in return for that, as part of the regulatory compact, you make a prudent decision, you recover your costs. That's helpful for us to know on the front end. And yes, at this juncture, there because we're in October of 2018, it feels a little bit disconnected from reality. But when we initially brought this forward, it was 2017, and the idea was that we would get an answer here and an answer in Minnesota, and we would have certainty that our regulators agreed with our decision. In terms of driving back to customers, customers are going to see this regardless of the ADP or not. And so I can't say that giving us an ADP today is going to assure customers that they're going to get those savings. But I think that it delivers a strong message to us that you agree with us. And I think that's helpful and meaningful. We've had a lot of discussions about integrated resource planning and things like that mm-hmm. as part of other proceedings. And this is a way that we have a conversation with this commission about the decisions that we want to make. And one of the things that's hard is if this is the only way that we can have that conversation, we're looking at these decisions somewhat in isolation.
Right.
And so the value of this is we get to have a conversation about other things that are happening.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that may not provide all of its full value because we're not dealing with all the facts yet either. Mm-hmm. And so having these come before you is helpful, but it could be more helpful if we also had some other pieces of regulatory construct to help. So us being able to have this discussion and being able to bring this forward and you saying, yes, go do this. You're starting to get a picture of what it looks like with our system, how it fits in, and we're getting a sense of what your sensitivities are, what your concerns are, so that we can continue to do a better and better job to serve our customers and to make sure that you as the voice and the proxy for our customers are happy with what our decisions are. That's pretty important for me personally, because that's my job.
Okay, very good. That concludes my questions. Thank you.
Follow-up questions for Mr. Chandrana?
Sure. Is there any way we can get a quick break, Your Honor?
Sure. It's almost 10:10, so we'll come back at 10:20.
Sounds good. Thank you, sir.
Okay, we've got everybody we need. We're going to go back on the record here. It's about 10:24 on the room clock. I'll just remind you, Mr. Chandrana, you're still under oath. Mr. Simpson?
I have no questions for the witness, Your Honor.
Well, that break was worth it then.
I thought I was in so much trouble.
Mr. Armstrong?
I have just a couple, just maybe clear up some numbers. Mr. Chandrana, Commissioner Krosh has asked you some questions about the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and how it had an effect and, kind of the numbers on it. And procedurally, when the company first brought the 1550 wind project, the PU-17-120,
okay.
Is it your recollection that the estimate was $1.6 billion in savings?
Yes.
And then In response to that, Mr. Heidel filed his testimony, and he thought the company's number was a little high, and he thought it was $1.417 billion in savings.
That's correct.
Okay. And then with the reevaluation with the TCJA, the company came back and said the effect of that on our estimate is $1.4 billion in savings. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Approximately.
Approximately.
And Mr. Heidel filed his supplemental testimony saying, you know, that's reasonable. He didn't really put a number to it.
That's correct.
And then with Dakota Range, the company filed its application, and then before Mr. Heidel filed any testimony, requested to supplement it based off of the TCJA. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And the company's estimate after that was $167 million in savings system-wide.
That's correct.
And $9 million of that would go to North Dakota customers.
That's correct.
Okay. And Mr. Heidel basically, he didn't put numbers to it, but said, you know, the numbers are reasonable anyway.
That's correct.
Okay. And you were asked some questions about the benefits to staff from the settlement agreement. And one of those is, with the PTCs, the agreement states that any PTCs that aren't captured by the company will not fall on customers, correct?
That's correct.
And then also we have the caps so that if any of the costs go above those caps for any particular project, the company would have to come in and prove that it was reasonable to go above that cap. Is that correct?
That's correct as well.
Okay, thank you. That's all the questions I have.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
I had a follow-up to Commissioner Fedorchuk's line of questioning. Is there any cost saving to company or ratepayers from granting an ADP? Or is it just a feel-good thing?
I think I said this to Commissioner Fedorchuk, which is granting an ADP is not going to change the cost savings, increase them, decrease them for customers. There's no more cost savings that are going to be generated by granting an ADP or not. So I think that there is a very direct answer, which is by settlement agreement, we have to file an ADP, and we file the ADP. And I also think that there is a policy basis of having these discussions on a forward-looking basis, which is very helpful from a rate-making perspective. But in terms of cost savings?
And is that just applicable in, like, you know, you're adding renewables and the commission wants to know what your plans are ahead of time, so this settlement is making you file them, or is that in general for any type of capital investment decision, there would be no cost saving to having a positive ADP case?
I can't speculate in that way. I can talk about this particular proceeding. If there's a situation where having an ADP allows us to make decisions that allows us to bring forward a more cost-effective project, that I'd have to see that on its own merits. But as it pertains for this set, I can't think of a reason one way or the other how granting the ADPs drives more cost savings.
Do you have any knowledge of the history of the ADP law or the legislative rationale for passing it? Was that part of your upbringing in the company?
No, it was not.
Okay, thanks. That's all I have.
Hey, Commissioners, any follow-up for Mr. Chandarana right now?
I have just one question. Is there an oversupply of turbines right now where manufacturers have built too many, and maybe it's more of the older style, and they're warehoused right now, and they're trying to push them out because now the PTC is starting to expire? Clock is ticking.
Commissioner Crosh, it's not that I'm aware of. I mean, not that I'm aware of. That would be a question that would be really well oriented towards a turbine manufacturer.
Right.
the best I can explain is that, you know, when we entered into our arrangement with our turbine supplier, we went through a lot of commercial negotiations to make sure that we got the best product for our customers that we could get. And something that we haven't really touched upon a whole lot is, as the tax bill went into effect and became a law, and we went back to all of our suppliers and vendors and negotiated even harder to make sure that we got the best deal for our customers. And as a result of that, we were able to drive some savings, including our turbine supplier.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Christman.
And following up on that, am I recalling correctly that whatever the name of the project is that's in Mercer and Morton counties was cited a number of years ago originally, correct?
I believe that's correct, yes.
And will you still be using the same turbine models as what were discussed in that original siting hearing?
Let me take a look at my the supplemental ADP, because I don't recall off the top of my head the answer to that question. Which, of course, I'm looking at something that's completely trade secret.
And you can get back to us later on that, too, if that's something that's hard to look up.
That would be appreciated.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Just please do get back to me on that. Okay. Then the last rate case, I have forgotten what year it was now, but not so long ago. Part of the rate case was the agreement on construction of a thermal generation unit in eastern North Dakota, correct?
Correct.
By 2025? Does that sound right?
I believe it was either 2024 or 2025. It's right around that wheelhouse there.
And so I'm coming back to that. But
okay.
With these, with getting these projects into the queue at MISO and figuring out the interconnection costs and that,
yes.
When did that process start on these projects?
I don't know exactly when that started, and I would imagine it was a couple of years ago.
It's a multi-year process.
Yes. Yep.
Has that process started for the thermal unit in eastern North Dakota?
Not that I'm aware of. And as part of our next integrated resource plan, we intend on bringing forward our plans for how we're going to serve the system over the next 15 years, at least in Minnesota. And I can tell you, at least in the preliminary discussions that we've had internally as a company, that we have every intention of bringing forward that thermal unit to be in service by 2024.
Okay. I don't have any questions more at this time, but after Mr. Martin, I may again.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Fedorchak.
No more questions for me.
Okay. Ms. Chandaranda, I think you can step down.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm going to leave a mess up here for you. Sorry, bud.
Just a minute, Mr. Chandran. I want to make sure. Did you have some follow-up you wanted to do?
No.
Okay. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Your Honor.
No. Ms. Jeff Kotsako?
No, thank you.
Okay. Good.
NSP calls Philip Joseph Martin.
Just because.
Mr. Martin, before I administer the oath, you heard me give the perjury admonition this morning, and you saw them put a heater by that seat, so you'll be in the hot seat. Raise your right hand, please. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Thank you. Mr. Simpson.
Thanks, Your Honor. Mr. Martin, your testimony has been pre-filed and stipulated to, so that's all part of the record. And I don't believe you have an opening statement. I just have a few questions based on the testimony we saw earlier to help sort of just clear a few things up. There's been some discussions with respect to NSP's announced closure of Sherco and how the wind modeling accounts for that. And does the model include the closure, the already announced closures of Sherco 1 and 2 in 2023 and 2026?
Yes, it does.
And so...
I'm sorry, I turned it right off.
Yes, it does.
And so would it be... And you're the director of resource planning, correct?
Correct.
And has the company announced any other plant retirements in addition to Sherco 1 and 2?
No.
It is not. Okay. Also, there's been some discussion with respect to the reliability of the system and who's responsible for that. And I think as Director of Resource Planning, you have some working knowledge of that, correct?
Correct.
With respect to the generator interconnection process itself, are you aware of the status of the generator interconnection agreements for each of the projects?
Yes.
Do all of the projects have generator interconnection agreements?
The majority of them do. A couple do not.
A couple do not. Okay. Now, through the MISO process, there's a series of studies. That's correct?
Correct.
And then once those studies are completed, then you enter into the interconnection agreement, if everything is okay with all the parties, correct?
Yes.
And those studies, what do they tend to look at?
The interconnection studies?
That's correct.
They basically look at the available capacity on the system. MISO runs their model, looks at the impact of interconnecting the new generation, determines if network or transmission upgrades are required, and if they are, those costs are then assessed on the project, or if no costs are required, then the project moves to the GIA phase.
So it would be fair to characterize those studies as saying what, if anything, to determine what, if anything, may be necessary on the transmission system to ensure that these generators can interconnect and generate reliably, correct?
Correct.
And once you enter a generator interconnection agreement, you have a fair amount of certainty around the costs and what those upgrades are, correct?
Yes, the costs are fully known at that time.
And just to clarify a question Commissioner Fedorchuk had, the projects that are part of this 1850, they're essentially using already existing transmission capacity, or are there significant additional transmission upgrades that are going to be necessary?
The ones that have secured GIAs, there, I believe for a couple of them, there were minor upgrades that were identified that will need to be completed for those projects to interconnect. But there are two, like I said, that are outstanding. I believe it's Blazing Star 2, and there's a third segment of the Crown Ridge project that those two are still believe Blazing Star 2 is in just started the study phase, and Crown Ridge 3 has not yet started its study phase.
So there's a fair amount more certainty with respect to in transmission interconnection costs, but not 100% certainty at this time.
Correct.
And your knowledge of the settlement agreement would indicate, would lead you to believe that the risk of those shifts would essentially land on the company subject to coming back to the commission. Is that correct?
Correct.
There was also some discussion. Now, with all that said, your model accounts for other impacts of reliability with respect to operating the plant, coal cycling costs, and the impacts to, you know, some of your generation using less as well as buying other generation in the market. Is that correct?
Correct.
And the operation of the plants is the responsibility of the utility itself, correct?
Yes.
Okay. There was also some discussion with respect to interconnection costs and why some projects didn't have them in our filings. Is it your understanding that those relate to the PPA projects?
Yes.
And why wouldn't we provide interconnection costs for PPA projects?
Because the PPA prices are fixed for us. The developers who are selling us the PPAs, the interconnection costs are their responsibility. So it's really not a consequence to us. The PPA price is fixed, so that's the price we will pay, regardless of what those interconnection costs are.
Okay. There was also some discussion about essentially making sure the wind farms run as you expect. How does your model account for that?
So we, I think the best way to answer that is we ran a number of sensitivities, looked at different production levels, so looked at plus or minus 5% capacity factor. So essentially one scenario looked at if the capacity factor was 5% lower, what would the savings be? We also looked at a markets off scenario where we were unable to sell any excess wind generation. We only served our own load, so basically turned off MISO market sales, so didn't consider any additional revenues that we would get from that. So ran those sensitivities and still showed significant savings for all the wind projects.
Now, MISO controls dispatch, is that correct?
They do.
So at the end of the day, it's MISO who gets to determine which generators are running where, correct?
Correct.
And that's all essentially based on the bids and offers in the market?
Yes.
Now, how do the wind farms interact with that? They're essentially the first to go, correct?
Correct.
And why is that?
So I think the majority of wind farms are probably offered in at $0 per megawatt hour since there's no fuel cost associated with wind, or at a negative price in the case where projects are earning PTCs. So given that that's the lowest marginal cost resource in the market, MISO will dispatch that resource down last.
So generally, if the wind is blowing, the wind is being dispatched into the market?
Correct.
And in what circumstances would that not be the case?
I think MISO may run into issues where they have some locational specific impacts where there's, you know, dense areas of wind where there may be some transmission or reliability issues and they might have to curtail wind. You know, typically it's not economic driven though, because if they can dispatch down, you know, coal or other resources that have a higher marginal cost, they'll do that first.
I have nothing further.
Mr. Armstrong. Excuse me.
No questions, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat Sacco.
Is the company capturing the full production tax credits on all of the projects, or 100% on all of them?
All of them but Dakota Range. On Dakota Range, we're capturing 80%.
Okay, and why the difference?
Because, sure, Dakota Range just came along a little bit later. The 1550 projects came out of our RFP process, and we secured those projects sooner. Dakota Range was actually bid into our RFP, just didn't make it through the process. We continued negotiations with them and secured a deal with them later on. So their construction starts in 2018, which means they only qualify for 80%.
Okay. And I was going to ask about in-service dates. Are the in-service dates, are any of them slipping, or are they the same as projected? Or
not to my knowledge, they should still be on track.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I have.
Commissioner Crocious.
Somewhere, and I've been digging through it, but I thought it was from Mr. Heidel's testimony, but I can't track it down. So, but one of the statements in is that the levelized cost of energy increases by 150% without the production tax credit. And I jotted it down, so at some point I read it wherever it came from. Can you help me reconcile that the approximate savings would drop roughly in half without the PTC, and yet levelized cost of energy increases by 150% without the PTC? Is that, yeah, maybe on the surface it doesn't make sense, but is that really, though, looking at the overall project cost and overall savings and then backing it off from there?
Sure. So we did not do any analysis that looked specifically at what the savings or anything like that, or what the levelized cost would be without the production tax credit. You know, since we expect to receive the production tax credit, we focused on that. You know, clearly the savings would be much less without the production tax credit. So not really sure what the specific LCOE impact would be. You know, at 100% production tax credit, that's $24 per megawatt hour. So clearly, and that's, you know, it's in effect for the first 10 years. So all production in the first 10 years gets a $24 per megawatt hour credit at 100%. So, you know, you would definitely see a large LCOE impact from taking that credit away.
And perhaps it's a moot point because as the settlement is proposed, North Dakota customers would be held harmless.
Right. Correct.
Should the PTC fail to be fully achieved or not achieved at all, however the scenario might work out. And then just to clarify, Dakota Range, that's because I think when you look at the testimony and it says, again, North Dakota customers are protected at 100% of the available PTC, which is actually 80%. So sometimes you read the 100% and... one of the statements, these facilities would be incented to run even with negative pricing. From an economic standpoint, that tells me that the market is fundamentally flawed. What are your thoughts on that?
that's a good question. You know, just thinking about it from purely economics, you know, if we... are, you know, a couple of these are PPAs, so we are on the hook to make the developer whole for the PTC should we curtail the output of the facility. So it's in our best interest and our customers' best interest to offer it in that way, because if the project doesn't run, we owe the developer, you know, $24 a megawatt hour grossed up for taxes potentially. Which means we'd rather operate at a negative $5 LMP and pay myself $5 to run so that our customers don't have to pay the developer the $24 per megawatt hour production tax credit value. So just purely from economics, it makes sense. It's in the best interest of our customers. So I think that's how we approach it.
How do you look at the long-term impact, though? Because negative pricing is going to eventually displace current assets, current generating facilities.
Sure.
And how do you reconcile the cost if there is a stranded asset? Would you expect to come back to the commission and say, you know, we're looking at an early retirement, you know, even beyond the Sherco units, and here's the recovery we need, which really could change the $1.4 billion in estimated savings. Or maybe it's not recognized. And, well, it's not a part of this right now. So it's not a part of the calculations in which a decision might be made.
Sure. So our view is, you know, ultimately market prices are influenced by gas prices, and Mr. Heidel references in his testimony that, you know, the MISO, IMM, and a lot of the reports they put out show that the majority of the time gas is setting the marginal cost in the market. Our view is that that's going to continue. MISO always needs a certain level of dispatchable generation online to help balance the system. So I think there's going to be a floor for LMPs. I don't think, even if you see a significant amount of negative LMP wind in the market, that you're going to see average annual prices decline below certain levels, because we just simply need thermal generation online to help balance the system, and that's what's always, or in the majority of hours, going to be setting the marginal cost in the market. So I think that's where you won't see significant price decreases, even with the influx of additional wind.
Is balancing the system, just help me out here, is that to meet the Minnesota mandate or other requirements?
I'm sorry, can you clarify that?
I believe you had just said to balance the system in terms of different generation sources.
Sure. So MISO needs to have certain thermal generation resources online and dispatchable, you know, available to meet load fluctuations. And I think that's across the system. So, you know, they're looking to serve load across the system. So they can't typically do that just with wind, since it's variable and you can't really control the output. So that's where, certainly if there's a lot of wind on the system, you'll take the wind because it's, you know, low marginal cost relative to other resources. But at a certain point, they always need coal or they always need gas. to be able to meet load fluctuations, and when there's a ramp, you know, allow the coal or the gas to ramp up, since you can't control the variable resource wind.
So that statement is strictly MISO driven, not because of renewable mandate.
Correct.
Or are the requirements that you're under from another state?
Correct.
Do you think, in terms of the long-term infrastructure costs, and this number is probably 5 to 6 months old, and I believe it was 2.3 to 2.4 trillion in additional infrastructure costs, in part half of it to alleviate grid congestion, the other half because of aging infrastructure. But that is the projection by the year between 2035 and 2040. That's really not factored into this. And I'm not talking about to replace aging infrastructure, but to address grid congestion related to renewables coming online. Do you think that's factored in any way in this settlement, or maybe not the settlement isn't the best way to put it, but in terms of the overall cost savings?
Sure. So our view is that certainly if there's going to be incremental wind in the future, there's going to be additional transmission infrastructure required. I think the majority of our projects were submitted into the MISO queue early enough that we're taking advantage of available capacity that's out there. Given the MVP lines that were built, given the CapEx 2020 lines that were built, there was kind of a highway that was constructed and it wasn't fully utilized, and this wind that we're adding is kind of filling that up. Now, again, beyond this wind, we definitely think there's going to be a need for additional infrastructure investment. MISO's been evaluating that in their MTEP process, and talking to our transmission folks, they've indicated that a lot of the cost-benefit analysis MISO's doing, looking at congestion and, you know, where lines could be built to alleviate congestion. At this time, MISO is not really able to justify any projects because the costs are much higher than the benefits. So I think that's what really compels us to bring these projects forward, is we think we can add these projects without significant infrastructure impacts. In the future, given the state of the MISO queue, we have, you know, real concerns that we're not going to be able to add incremental wind, or it's going to be very difficult to add incremental wind and justify the costs of additional transmission investment.
This might be more of a philosophical question, so you can decline if you wish, but I would like to hear your thoughts. So going to the customer base, you know, in terms of the overall system, a $1.4 billion savings, $75 million in North Dakota, and I'm trying to remember if that's with the plus, with the 9 from Dakota Range, or the 75 includes the Dakota Range.
I don't think it does.
It doesn't. So 84.
Sorry. 84, yep.
Do you think that deserves an asterisk in terms of, okay, here's the system savings, but if a person pays federal taxes, which the PTC is supported by, and in North Dakota, I believe it's around 70% of the population, people pay federal tax in North Dakota. I think nationwide it's closer to half, so we're higher than average. But it's a utility bill you don't see. Do you think how do you communicate that, or is that, well, this is the marketplace, these are the incentives that are available, and I realize it doesn't go into the rate-making process, but it's that second hidden utility bill. Would you agree?
I think it's a fair point. You know, I think it's there's a lot of commodities out there and different things that are included in taxes that the government provides subsidies to. You know, I think what we're trying to do is our NSP system, we're trying to capture those incentives for our customers. You know, the government designs the rules, we don't. So we're just trying to, you know, benefit our customers the best that we can. You know, given the size of North Dakota and some of our other, you know, population centers in the NSP system, you know, if you think about the tax base in the U.S., you know, other states are contributing to those federal tax dollars and contributing to those PTC payments that we get. And there's, you know, a lot denser populations along the East Coast and Florida and other states like that that aren't necessarily benefiting from the addition of wind projects. So I guess that would be my take.
All right. Thank you.
Commissioner Christman.
If I understood your testimony earlier, it was different than what my recollection was of looking at the protected files. Did you say that Blazing Star 2 interconnection costs are not final yet?
Those are still being studied. It's still in the study process.
And what was the other one, Clean Energy 1 or Crown Ridge?
Crown Ridge 3.
But Clean Energy 1 is available?
Clean Energy, I believe, has a GIA. So that's the PPA project that we have. It's an elite project. That's a PPA. And I believe that's the one in Mercer and Morton counties.
Maybe it just wasn't included because of what you said earlier about the PPA doesn't really matter since it would be the owner that would have the responsibility, so maybe that's why it wasn't in there?
Right. The risk is totally on Elite, not us.
But in the other cases where I had mentioned earlier that I felt that what I thought I recalled seeing was numbers for both Blazing Star 1 and 2. And that they seemed higher than others.
Sure.
But for whichever ones aren't finalized, it's the testimony today that the agreement will protect the ratepayers from those costs. It will fall to the company if they go over.
Correct.
If they go real high, since they're not final.
Correct. In our cost estimates and our modeling, we included costs for transmission that were estimates at the time. But as part of the agreement, we have a termination provision where if costs exceed a certain amount, we can get out of those contracts.
Okay. And then I'm also notes from Mr. Heidel's written testimony dated August 20th. The company does not have updated forecasts of congestion costs, wind integration costs, which we just talked about, or coal plant cycling costs. Is that correct, or is he wrong and you do have updated forecasts for those?
No, that is correct. We used Enernex was a consultant that we had used in our previous IRP, and they had done a study looking at all of those costs, with the exception of congestion costs, and we had used the values that were provided in their study. Now we have contacted them and we're using them again for our upcoming IRP, so they're refreshing that analysis, but that is correct. In our modeling for this, we used the old values from the last IRP.
Could they have changed significantly?
What we're seeing in the initial analysis is they have not changed significantly, and actually they've gone down in some cases.
Does the settlement agreement protect the customers if that would not be the case?
So I think that's where we conducted some of the sensitivities that I talked about and just, you know, looked at markets off. You know, we did not run any sensitivities looking at higher levels of congestion, but we did look at, you know, the different production levels, assuming 5% of curtailment. So we still showed significant savings there, so still think customers are protected and there's going to be savings regardless.
So between these two notes of mine in studying for this, between some of the unknown interconnection costs and these other forecasts being aged, I had written the question to myself, how do we determine prudence without that information? Is it your testimony that the answer to that is that the settlement would protect the consumers, and if there are additional significant costs, it would fall to the company and not the consumers, and so is it prudent?
I'm not aware that there's any guarantees in the agreement that that enable that. But again, that's where we conducted the sensitivity analysis. You know, the savings may be less than what we forecasted in our modeling. But again, that's why we ran sensitivities, because we wanted to stress some of the key variables and see, are there still significant savings if some of these variables change in a direction that's not favorable to customers. So
that's
we feel
dated studies. But,
correct. We're still
interconnection costs. It's
the consumers are protected.
The interconnection costs, the customers are protected because of the termination provisions. My thought is that customers, you know, we continually look at congestion costs, and as I said, we're working with Enernex to refresh that study. What we've seen from Enernex is those costs have not changed significantly, so I still think the costs that we use in the modeling are valid. And then from a congestion perspective, we continue to monitor that. You know, don't feel that congestion values have changed significantly either. So really what we did in our modeling is we applied like a $5 or $6 per megawatt hour discount to wind production based on our estimates of the impacts of congestion costs and, you know, some of the cycling costs, some of those other things. So we definitely, you know, discounted the value of the wind to account for those costs.
Do you think utility regulators have a kind of a dual responsibility, one to keep rates reasonable and just for the consumers, but another also to keep the company strong?
Yes.
So when we rely on the answer that certain things that are maybe unclear are protected because the company won't be able to pass additional costs in that area along to the consumers, isn't that sort of ignoring the second part of that, where we also have a responsibility to keep the company strong? Because if you experience additional costs for something here that aren't clear as we make these decisions, and you're not allowed to pass them on for recovery, that's not helping keep the company strong. So,
sure,
square that up for me.
Well, my understanding is that if the savings are reduced, customers, you know, are still paying for the projects and you know, just not realizing a significant amount of savings. So, you know, the MISO market revenue is all passed through the fuel clause, based on my understanding. So if we're selling into MISO at a lower rate and don't see some of the benefits for customers that we projected in the modeling, then that's just a reduction in customer savings, but the company is still being held whole.
You had said something to the effect of these are using kind of available capacity of MISO transmission infrastructure, correct?
Correct.
But in probably the not distant future, more capacity will be needed.
Correct.
Okay, I'm more familiar with the highway byway system at SPP than with how MISO does things. But if more capacity, you do these projects and take up most of the available capacity, and then in the not distant future, they need to add additional capacity for others to do their projects. As a MISO member, don't you help pay for the cost of those upgrades?
We would if there was some sort of MVP round two type process. Yes, we would. I'm sure we would get cost allocated a share of whatever those expenses are.
So aren't we kind of kidding ourselves to assume that, well, this is kind of transmission-free because there's this capacity, when in fact what we're doing is using up a great deal of the capacity and thus causing the need for more to be built, and then those costs really should be associated with these projects as well?
Well, I think that's where the costs of the future transmission will certainly impact the decisions around future wind additions. You know, I think in this case, the transmission was viewed by us as kind of a sunk cost. It had been committed to. It was under construction. The majority of it is in service now. So it was us taking advantage of that capacity and taking advantage of the PTC benefits for customers, and adding the wind ahead of the need to build new transmission and maybe having to fund transmission ourselves. Because I think that's one of the, again, going back to the fact that the MISO process is a little bit stalled, they're having difficulty showing cost benefits of building more large-scale transmission. So I think a lot of the projects that are in the queue are going to be forced to fund upgrades themselves. So individual developers are going to get hit with potentially significant upgrades, and it's not going to go to a MVP-type process where those costs are allocated to kind of all the regional utilities and customers.
Why? I don't understand why it wouldn't. In the past, we've done MVP projects, spread the costs around.
Sure.
If the capacity is saturated and more is needed, why wouldn't it be another MVP project?
My understanding is how the first MVP round of projects was justified was, I think, you know, MISO continually does cost-benefit analysis, so I'm not fully sure, but I'm guessing that they were able to show a benefit to building all of the transmission lines in the original MVP process. I think some of that was spurred by some of the portfolio standards that were enacted by states within MISO. But just being able to show a benefit helped justify those projects, and that's where not being able to show a benefit currently is kind of a problem and blocking the ability to build more large-scale transmission.
Okay, and lastly, I think lastly, and I'm sorry I can't find it, so I can't reference who said it or when it came up, okay. But somewhere along the line, we were told that the Minnesota Public Utility Commission ordered the company to acquire at least 1,000 megawatts of wind by 2020. Because I can't find the date of that, is that 1,000 part of this? Or I thought I understood the previous witness say that, you know, you've got the renewable mandates covered in Minnesota. This is about cost savings. So has that 1,000 been met by other projects already, or is this part of meeting that 1,000 megawatt requirement?
This is part of meeting that 1,000 requirement.
Okay. I don't have any other questions. Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Fedorchuk.
All right. Just a few follow-ups, PJ. Thank you. My greatest concerns are, actually, my only reservations about this relate to the congestion and the company's ability to actually realize the savings, as we discussed earlier. So MISO market zone one is, are all of these in zone one?
Yes.
And that's the zone that has the greatest congestion.
I have not done an analysis to look at levels of congestion in MISO. I have heard that in MISO South, there's significant levels of congestion, so it's possible that one of the zones down there has greater congestion.
Yeah. It's one of the problem areas, so.
Sure.
And can you tell me which of the two projects does not have the interconnection agreement again?
I was late marking them. Blazing Star 2 is still okay. Going through the study process, and the... So Crown Ridge, there was a 300-megawatt PPA associated with Crown Ridge and a 300-megawatt BOT associated with Crown Ridge, and their interconnection was broken into three segments. It was three 200-megawatt segments, and the last 200 megawatts was in, I believe it was the February 17 queue, so that one has not yet been studied.
Okay. Is it still anticipated that all of those will be up and running by fourth quarter of next year then, or is that one remaining 200 megawatts likely to be later?
Sure. I believe those are 2020 in service dates.
All of them or just the...
Just those two with the transmission uncertainty okay. still associated with them.
All right. And if they can't get an interconnect, they just won't happen?
Potentially. Or if the costs are too high, we have the ability to terminate okay. the contracts.
What can you just tell me your definition of congestion costs?
Sure. So if you think about locational marginal prices in MISO, you know, different locations in MISO, all generators, all different load nodes have their own published LMP. And the locational marginal price, or LMP, is composed of three components. It's the energy, congestion, and losses. So congestion basically reflects the price differential in different locations, assuming there's transmission constraints that are limiting, you know, the free flow of energy throughout the system. So if there were no transmission constraints on the MISO system, LMPs throughout the entire footprint would be the same. But because there's transmission constraints, there can be overloads, there can be, you know, too much generation, too little generation in different locations. That's where you see congestion values deviate, and LMPs are different at different locations in the market.
So they really curtail the ability of the resources from, say, Zone 1 to effectively make it into the market, don't they?
So
this congestion issue.
Yeah, so what we can see is for example, in South Dakota or southern Minnesota, where you have dense pockets of wind, you know, if it's a very high wind day and there's a significant amount of wind generation in a specific location, there might not be enough transmission outlet to allow that wind to flow to load centers like in the Twin Cities or elsewhere. So, yes, it's possible that you could see low LMPs in southern Minnesota or South Dakota and higher LMPs in the Twin Cities area where we're buying our load from MISO.
And then that low LMP could result in you not producing.
It could. We could reduce production, or we could just be selling into the market at a lower LMP relative to what we're buying our load at.
So in the whole MISO planning process, my experience with MISO is that they view themselves as being the marketplace, and they don't make decisions about who can and cannot come on if it's technically feasible. Anybody can.
Correct.
And whether or not they can be profitable, that's up to the person proposing the project. So knowing that, who's looking at what makes sense, and how do you guys factor in what makes what's happening all in Zone 1, all the projects that are going on, to assure that there's going to be demand for all this new generation so that you can actually make the money and realize the savings and not be left paying for a bunch of wind farms that are not producing?
Sure. So I think that's where our markets off sensitivity and the modeling that we did is helpful. In that, we assume that we're not able to buy or sell, from MISO. We're only serving our own load with our own generation. So what you see if you look at that modeling in detail is the additional wind production that we're adding here is simply displacing coal, natural gas resources that, you know, have dispatch marginal costs because they're burning fuel, and we're avoiding that fuel by adding this wind. So I think that's...
So I have a roadblock with this markets off thing because you cannot serve your own generation without MISO.
Correct.
It's your own load.
It's not a realistic
view. How is
this
a reality?
It's an island view. But that, if you think about, that's an island view looking at our system. You know, when we turn markets on, that is enabling kind of the market access. And that's where we're getting credit because we're able to sell some of our excess wind production. So we're trying to not, when we take the island view, it's kind of a more conservative view, because we're not crediting ourselves with sales to the market. So I think that's where we really focus on those sensitivities to make sure that it makes sense even under kind of an extreme condition, which may not necessarily be realistic.
Is there a cap out there or any sort of a control out there that will prevent this scenario that I'm concerned about? The flooding of the market with these projects, because you've got all this and there's umpteen others in MISO Zone 1 that are trying to do the same thing. What is the cap or the control from what the scenario I'm anticipating or fearing from happening?
Sure. So I think, you know, again, MISO is responsible for the reliability of the system. you know,
not if, worried about reliability.
Sure.
I mean, there's tons of electricity, or going to be tons of electricity out there. I'm not worried about that.
Okay.
I'm worried about you guys being able to actually produce and pay for these and realize these savings.
Sure. You know, again, what's happening is you're displacing production from other resources. So you're just simply going to see less production from coal resources, less production from gas resources, and this wind is going to serve load instead of the other resources. So,
and if there's so much excess even beyond that to serve that load, which I think maybe it's not what's happening today in MISO, but things can change quick in a few years, how do you know? How do you factor that into your modeling?
So I think a lot of the projects you see in the MISO queue right now are going to be curbed because they're going to have their studies done and they're going to have network upgrade or transmission interconnection costs that are far beyond what they're able to pay and keep the projects economic. So I think what you see in the queue is not what is going to interconnect in the next few years. A lot of it's going to drop out, and again, I think our projects have good interconnection position and are able to use that capacity that's available with the MVP projects.
Okay. The last area that I want to talk to you about was kind of what Randy was getting at, the cost of transmission and how that gets built into these costs. I'm not questioning the value, the wind value, but I do get a little concerned that the total cost isn't really reflected in the prices, because maybe there isn't a new MVP system that is needed to serve these, but certainly the last MVP system is serving these, and those costs are being collected in a whole different revenue stream on customers' bills and aren't really ever reflected in the price of anybody's new resources when they're bringing them on and modeling. So you don't really have a true cost comparison. And so I think it's one of the reasons why over time customers are hearing about all this low cost energy, but their bills aren't dropping because there's other factors that are increasing that weren't there before. That being said, what MISO seems to be doing is they can't justify the new MVPs, or they can't get enough enthusiasm and support for them, so they're basically changing their cost allocation, and now they're going to this MEP and allowing the same cost allocation from the MVP down to the MEP level. So there will be new generation added, lower voltage, that will be allocated throughout the system, just like the MVPs were, and that will be to serve stuff like this and others, and perhaps the new ones. So those costs also aren't reflected in these costs in terms of the price of these projects.
True, but you know, I don't know that a lot of MEP specific projects have been identified yet, or I'm not aware. Mm-hmm. I don't follow that extremely closely. But certainly, you know, MISO is going to continue to look at. They run a model called ProMod that looks at the future state of the system, makes assumption about where new resources are going to be added, and then calculates LMPs at different locations to look at. You know, if we build a transmission line here, it's going to help alleviate some of the congestion that we're seeing, and low LMPs and the high LMPs in different mm-hmm. locations will be equalized. So certainly MISO is going to continue to do that, look for opportunities to build transmission. I think we support that. If we get into situations where we have specific areas of the system that are seeing very low LMPs and we have resources there and it's to our benefit to build a transmission line to alleviate that congestion, and help customers, then we will do that. But certainly I think there's going to be more scrutiny on transmission projects in the future. And, you know, I understand your concern with mm-hmm. the previous round of MVP lines being built. But again, we viewed that as kind of a sunk cost going into this. And we think we're using that available capacity for these projects, and that's why they make sense.
One final question. One of the realities that gives me comfort with this type of a build-out, significant amounts of wind, is realizing that even within, even if you don't have demand for all of it within MISO, which I believe you guys think there that does exist, but if there's a huge bailout in MISO, there is a huge demand outside of MISO and PJM for renewables. So do you see that as an opportunity longer term for your for projects like this just coming online, just knowing that there's a huge appetite beyond even the MISO region for these renewable resources, and this is the best place to generate them?
Sure. I think it's going to be difficult. Like if you're talking about serving load in PJM with wind in North Dakota, I think that would be very difficult unless you were to build some like HVDC, you know, high voltage transmission lines to transport that energy directly into the other market. So I view it as more, you know, we're going to build the wind to serve the regional area. And I think it's going to be very difficult to justify building HVDC lines kind of across the country.
Yeah.
Though I know there have been a lot of studies that are looking at that possibility right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks, PJ.
Sure.
Redirect.
Yes, Your Honor. A few items, PJ. Thank you. Hopefully you can educate me today as well. Let's start just sort of with the concept of how the wind projects are providing customer savings. If I'm reading through this, there's essentially three components: the PTC component, the offset fuel cost component, and then the revenue from market sales. Is that a fair way to think about it?
Sure.
And so Commissioner Krosh has talked about, well, it's fundamentally a moot point what the impact of the if the PTCs were here or not, because we're doing this to capture the PTCs. Is that fair, too?
That's fair.
And so that's a material component of where the cost savings are coming from.
Correct.
And in the settlement agreement, the company has agreed to hold customers harmless if all of the available PTCs are not captured by the company, correct?
Yes.
And that also means that it's 100% for every project but Dakota Range, correct?
Correct.
And Dakota Range is the 80% PTCs.
Yes.
And at those PTC levels, all of the projects are cost-effective from your point of view, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Now, the other component is the offset fuel costs, correct?
Correct.
And you were talking to Commissioner Fedorchak about the markets off scenario, correct?
Correct.
Is that a way that you can measure the offset fuel cost components?
Compared to our system, correct, yes.
And really because you're saying I'm not paying for this amount of fuel because I'm taking zero incremental cost wind instead.
Exactly, yep.
And so that island look really helps you to isolate that piece.
Correct.
And when you were looking at that island look, these projects were cost effective in every way, shape, or form.
Yes.
And you're essentially trying to mark the amount of fuel savings based on your projections of your fuel costs into the future, correct?
Correct.
But no matter what, you have to pay something for fuel, correct?
Right.
Okay. Now let's talk about the third cost, which is market revenue, right? Now market revenue is essentially the fact that you're creating energy at a particular load node and then selling that into the market, correct?
Yes.
Now you receive none of those revenues for the PPA projects.
Well, we do.
You do? Okay.
We do.
So this means that if you own it or don't own it, no matter what, there's a component of cost savings that are coming from the revenue at the load node for the generator, correct?
At the generator node, correct.
Okay. And so even if LMP prices are negative, you're still going to make some money by selling them because of the PTC savings, correct?
Correct.
And your assumption and analysis of the savings from the market revenue are based on your view of market forecasts.
Correct.
And you testified today that you believe that there's going to be some floor of LMPs, mainly because you need gas prices on an annual average basis.
Correct.
And even though there's negative LMP pricing at some hours of the year, you don't believe that that really mitigates the fact that over the course of any given year, you're going to get positive revenue from all of this.
Correct.
But nobody knows what that's ultimately going to be, right?
Right.
So from that perspective, that's how you capture all of the different cost savings values of the wind projects, correct?
Right.
And to the extent there's congestion and the wind can't necessarily make it to NSP load, you're still capturing the cost savings from all of those things regardless, correct?
Right, and we included a cost for congestion, like I mentioned.
And you've measured different sensitivities that ultimately allow you to not only isolate the savings, but also to sort of figure out that there's going to be some range of outcomes, right?
Right.
And we've been throwing around $1.4 billion today as the net savings of all these projects, but that's really just your best estimate, right?
Correct.
That's not a mathematical certainty. But no matter what happens in the future, is it your belief that there are going to be savings of some material magnitude that it makes sense to move forward with these projects?
Yes.
Now, if you take that, then we look at where we landed with our settlement agreement. And we did include some cost protections there, but I think there were some very good and astute questions asked about what savings are we capturing for our customers and what savings are we not, and because there's some differences there. Your recollection of the settlement, would it be fair to characterize it as saying that we're capping the capital costs that the company can spend on these projects, and that's really the protection for ratepayers?
Yes.
And that's really about what ends up going into rate base and is reflected in rates, correct?
Correct.
And with respect to getting an ADP for the PPA projects, really that ADP allows us to recover those, but those are fixed price.
Correct.
Now, but with respect to the PTC component of the cost savings, we're holding customers harmless. We've agreed to that, correct?
Right.
But there is no guarantee in the settlement agreement with respect to market pricing or what the actual cycling costs or what actually congestion costs or any of those sort of adders in your model are. Is that correct?
Yes.
But you think regardless of what range of reasonable or quite frankly unreasonable outcomes, do you think there's still materially enough savings to make these projects prudent?
I do. Well, yeah, $1.4 billion, you know, even with the sensitivities we ran, the savings were still significant. So I think, you know, there's definitely going to be savings.
And your sensitivities are what, about one standard deviations from the mean?
Yeah.
And that's sure. Fair. So, but even if you were to increase those sensitivities, we're still in hundreds of millions of dollars of savings, correct?
Correct.
So even in, except for the zombie apocalypse, in most worst case scenarios, we're still seeing material cost savings that make these projects make sense.
Yes.
Okay. Now, the last place... one more thing with respect to your model. There was some talk about, well, if these wind projects are offsetting your existing generation, right? Your model takes account of that, doesn't it?
Yes.
And how does it do that?
It reduces the dispatch on the existing thermal plants.
And because your model has outputs and present value of revenue requirements, the impacts to customers are captured from that perspective.
Yes.
So that 1.4 or several hundred million in cost savings to customers, that includes the impacts of keeping existing plants in rates, but not necessarily running them all the time.
Yes.
Okay. So fundamentally, it just makes sense to go ahead and add these wind projects.
Yes.
Now, one last point here is, well, then, what's really driving this? And I think I wanted to make sure that the record reflected the fact that, yes, the commission ordered this 1,000 megawatts in your last IRP. Was the company pursuing the wind projects prior to that PUC order?
Yes.
And do you believe that that Minnesota PUC order was ordered to make sure that you met the renewable mandates, or what was the rationale that the Minnesota Commission used?
I think it was economics. We were aware of what we thought wind pricing was in the market and wanted to pursue projects. And, you know, I think that's why we issued an RFP for a higher megawatt amount than the 1,000 we asked for, up to 1,500 megawatts.
And the exact language of the Minnesota Commission is in the record, I believe. I don't remember where it is. But to confirm then, it was essentially that the company was looking at wind projects beforehand. The Minnesota Commission found at least 1,000 megawatts to be economic. And you went into the market and said, well, it's actually, as of today, 1850. That's really economic.
Correct.
All right. Thank you. No further questions.
Mr. Armstrong.
No questions.
Ms. Jeff Kotsacko.
No questions.
Okay. Commissioners, Mr. Crocious.
No further questions.
Mr. Crispin.
I want to go back to the transmission capacity again. Okay. Am I summarizing what you said accurately, that there's capacity here, so these can be added pretty economically, but at some point, if you were to wait a lot longer, that will be saturated, and then the costs for interconnection and transmission will get much higher for future projects, correct?
Correct.
And you said that it's still expected that you will build the Red River Valley Thermal Unit.
Yes. Well, I believe Mr. Chandarana said that, but I can confirm that, yes.
That was around 200 or 250 megawatts, something like that, right?
Correct, yeah. That's about the size of our generic CT.
And I think we also heard this morning that there was likely a combined cycle gas plant to be built at the Sherco 1 and 2 site?
Correct.
So those will need transmission. Are those each of those facilities in the queue already and have space?
So the combined cycle facility at Sherco, we're hoping we can use the existing interconnection rights there that the coal units have currently. So with Sherco 1 and 2 retiring in 23 and 26 and the combined cycle plan to come online in 26, there's interconnection rights that we think we can transfer. MISO's
are you
still,
sure, or are you just hoping?
Well, MISO's still defining that process and has proposed interconnection transfer right rules, but I think we're still waiting on FERC approval of that, so it's still somewhat uncertain. As far as the North Dakota site goes, yes, it would be a greenfield combustion turbine site, so we would have to enter into the MISO queue for that.
So theoretically, by using up the capacity that's available right now, it will drive up the cost of that transmission for that plant when the time comes.
So since it's a combustion turbine, and again, it might be helpful to get a transmission expert up here, but I think the way the MISO queue studies work is they study resources in the on-peak and the off-peak, and you get into trouble with wind in the off-peak primarily, so any resources that are studied in the off-peak, that's where the interconnection costs will arise. A CT is only studied in the on-peak, I believe. So talking to our transmission folks, they've indicated that they don't think there will be as many issues with a combustion turbine interconnection because you're not competing with wind in the off-peak.
On the combined cycle plant for a Sherco, isn't it reasonable to project that having this additional intermittent power on the system is going to lessen the amount of time that combined cycle will be able to run at full capacity?
Yes, that's possible. And
so the efficiency of that is going to be reduced?
The capacity factor will definitely be reduced. Combined cycles and CTs, we expect them to operate at a range of different capacity factors, and they're flexible generation, and they're able to turn on and off kind of as needed. I think that's where, like, coal units have a much harder time doing that, shutting off, turning back on. So that's one thing that's going to help us in the future as more wind comes online. I think you'll see us transition to more flexible natural gas-type resources, and that'll help us more efficiently balance the wind because we just will have more resources that are able to ramp quickly and address the fluctuations from the variable resources.
But especially in the case of the combined cycle, wouldn't that plant require, wouldn't it be more efficient if it didn't face the competition from your own intermittent generation sources if we go ahead with this?
Sure, it would certainly run at higher capacity factors. And then, on an hourly basis, I think the higher a unit can operate, typically the lower its heat rate. So yes, if it needs to ramp down to minimum levels, there may be some efficiency losses from operating at those lower levels.
Does your model calculate those losses or reduced potential profits into this modeling forecast?
Sure. Typically, we do look at different dispatch ranges and try to factor that into the model. But I think, you know, and I think this came up during Mr. Chandaranda's testimony, is that Mr. Heidel had mentioned that Strategist has some limitations because it operates under a load duration curve type methodology and not an hourly chronological dispatch methodology. So some of the ramping and the hour-to-hour variability that occurs in reality is not captured. It's not as granular as some other models, but we feel that even at the higher level, we're still capturing, you know, what we need to capture, and I think Mr. Heidel confirmed that in his testimony.
No other questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
I don't have any more questions.
Counsel.
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Mr. Armstrong.
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
No, thank you.
Okay, Mr. Martin, you're excused. Thank you. Mr. Simpson.
The company has no further witnesses.
Mr. Armstrong.
We call Victor Shook.
Mr. Shook, raise your right hand. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding.
I do.
Thank you. Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you. Mr. Shook, where do you work?
Work for the Public Service Commission.
And what's your position?
I'm a public utility analyst.
Have you been appointed to advocacy staff in this case?
Yes, I have.
And have you prepared opening remarks?
Yes, I have.
Please provide them.
Morning, commissioners. My name is Victor Shook. I'm representing advocacy staff in this proceeding. I'm here today to support the settlement agreement between Xcel Energy and advocacy staff, granting conditional prudence for 9 projects that make up Xcel Energy's 1,852.4 megawatt wind portfolio. When the company submitted these filings, skeptical as to whether or not it would be a prudent course of action. It's a large amount of wind to be added in a very short time window. However, based on the company's analysis and the analysis done by our expert, Mr. Heidel, I find that adding these resources to the NSP system is prudent, and doing so will lower overall system costs. The Commission has expressed concerns in the past about the impact of wind generation on more traditional resources. However, these projects, along with many others in the MISO footprint, will be built regardless of the Commission's decision in these cases. Therefore, denying prudency for these projects would only deny long-term cost savings for NSP's North Dakota customers and not prevent the projects or others from being built. In addition to cost savings, the settlement agreement provides safeguards that protect these savings for customers. If the company is able to complete these projects under budget, 100% of the savings will flow to customers. If the company does not complete the projects within budget, the company will have to come back before the commission and prove that the additional expenditures are prudent before those costs can be passed on to customers. And lastly, if the projects are not completed on time and thereby do not receive the PTCs as planned, 100% for the majority and 80% for the Dakota Range, the company is at risk for those costs. No loss of PTCs will be passed on to customers. These provisions are in line with traditional rate-making principles and this commission's historical decisions. For these reasons, I recommend the commission adopt the settlement agreement. I look forward to addressing any questions you may have.
Tender Mr. Shook for questions.
Okay, Mr. Simpson.
No questions, Your Honor.
Ms. Armstrong. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle, I'm sorry.
That's all right. No questions.
Okay. Commissioners, Commissioner Kosius.
I thought I missed something over there. I didn't bring a present. I didn't do anything. On the stranded asset question I had asked earlier, you referred to it in terms of displacing a traditional source. How do you factor that in, or do you think it... if these projects over the long term displace a current asset in use, and then there are costs associated with unrealized depreciation, decommissioning, et cetera, do you think it would be fair to hold North Dakota ratepayers harmless?
Kind of generally, I would say yes. I mean, in that scenario you're laying out there, so how these resources would impact something like Sherco, early retirement, we don't factor in because, as per the current schedule, it's Sherco, I don't think, is going to be shut down because they're adding all of these wind resources. It's for other reasons. And I can say that when that day comes that they come and try to ask for those costs of the stranded asset, you know, generally advocacy staff would probably be opposed to that recovery, and it would be up to the commission to decide if, at that time anyway, whether or not they should be able to recover those. So for those reasons, we don't factor in that type of scenario.
Only one other question. What's your level of comfort on long-term infrastructure costs? It's been referred to a number of times. Additional transmission down the road as to address congestion, et cetera. It's really not factored in either, correct?
It's not. The longer term kind of look that you're talking about, I don't think is factored into these costs. No.
Okay, no other questions. Thank you, Victor.
Commissioner Christman.
So I get the benefits of the settlement agreement with respect to capping some costs and some things that you address in that last paragraph of the first page. But outside of that, in the previous paragraph, you say denying prudency for these projects would only deny long-term cost savings for NSP's customers in North Dakota. Why would it deny them? And Sarah Cardwell's testimony previously was that any cost savings can be captured in a future rate case.
And they certainly could. I guess that was, it's just a couple of different ways of looking at it, I guess. So they can certainly, you know, we could deny this, and we could capture those savings in a future rate case. I had a thought, and it just kind of left my mind here, so I'm trying to wind it back in. So by denying this ADP and this, well, more so the settlement, we would remove those protections that we've agreed to. So
the part in the last paragraph.
Right. So the caps on the costs would be kind of wiped away, and the company would come in, and we'd kind of have the burden of proof at that time to say, yeah, that cost is too much. The PTCs, you know, it's a lot easier for the company to make those arguments down the road when these are in service and they didn't achieve 100% of PTCs, or they went over cost for some reason. Well, we tried our best, and this happened or that happened. In this situation, the burden is on them to prove, well, we already looked at these in depth and we said this is a prudent amount. Why is this higher amount prudent?
And if the amount of those potential savings by agreeing to the settlement and having those caps in place, if those are relatively small amounts, then you could argue, well, it's a wash because there's that, but then there was also the alternative opportunity that going ahead with these projects eliminated a chance that maybe some better idea, maybe a better subsidy program that could be mined later would have come along, and there might have been something cheaper had we just waited a couple years.
Sure.
So if it's a small amount, I get that. You have to make a judgment call. But if it's a large amount that the caps protect the consumers from, then are we really protecting? Because then doesn't our other responsibility to make sure that the company is strong kick in? And we end up, if they're taking this big loss and we have the settlement that they can't recover it, but it's going to really materially harm the company's ability to provide good service, we end up giving it to them anyway.
That's potentially true, I guess. You know, the company would have, you know, first of all, it would be on them in this case to, I don't think they would have signed the settlement agreement if they didn't feel confident that this would keep them whole and not cause financial harm. And then over the longer term, Xcel is a very large company with lots of resources. I think they would do a reasonably good job at proving up a case where, you know, let's say they spent an extra $200 million, for example. If it's really prudent and necessary, I think they would have the wherewithal to prove that up.
Well, regarding the first part of your answer, I'm less confident after the biomass cases. No other questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Victor, thanks for mentioning those additional benefits of the ADP and the loss of those if we just say, well, bring it to us in a rate case. If it came back and did it in it like brought these projects back in a rate case, and they show that they're used and useful, mm-hmm. and they're producing benefits for the customers, we wouldn't really be able to decline them at that point, would we?
We might be able to challenge them on a cost basis. You know, if that were the issue that they went over.
So we could still recap some of those potential costs.
We could.
Costs.
It's, I think it's more challenging in a rate case than in a separate kind of a mm-hmm. setting like this, because we can look at these resources closer. We're in a rate case. We're looking at everything.
Mm-hmm.
There's generally a lot of things going on.
And in regards to the whole issue of this is our opportunity to have these discussions. ADP is our opportunity to have planning discussions with this company. Isn't this what we've been asking them to do? Come to us with ADPs?
Yes, absolutely. We required it in a prior settlement.
Okay. And so what kind of a message does it signal if we say, now just bring it back to us in a rate case?
It's very true. It could signal lots of things, but I mean, I think it was, I don't recall if you and Randy were on the commission at the time that previous settlement requiring this was approved or not. I know it was before my time here.
Well, it's been for 2014, I think, since we had a rate case with Xcel. So I don't remember all that was in that one, I have to be honest. I know we required it to come for some, but I don't remember if it was all of them. Okay, you've heard all of my crazy questions on congestion and concerns. You have a lot of experience in SPP, and they have a lot more wind.
We do.
Being actually making its way into market. Are you hearing about projects? Is there overbuilding in SPP that you're hearing about and hearing about projects not being able to be economic as a result?
Not that I have heard of within SPP. They, as you said, they have a large amount of wind relative to most other RTOs. I think they have by far exceeded 50% of their load at any given one point from wind, and their system was able to handle that with minimal curtailments. I think the highest that I recall hearing, I think they had to curtail 1,000 megawatts of wind out of 16,000 available.
Mm.
I mean, granted, that was a middle of the night type of a scenario, but their system with that higher percentage of wind has been able to handle it very well.
Okay. All right. I think that's it for me. Thanks.
Hey, counsel. Mr. Armstrong, any follow-up?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Simpson?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No. Thank you.
Hey, Mr. Shook, I think you can step down. So where do we go from here, Mr. Armstrong?
Judge, advocacy staff has no further witnesses to call. Mr. Heidel is available by telephone in the event there are any questions for him. So absent that, we rest.
Okay. Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Heidel? Mr. Simms here.
I don't. Nope.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
No, sir.
Commissioners. Commissioner Crocious.
No, I don't.
No, sir.
Okay. So, all right. So you rest.
Correct.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, anything else to present today?
No.
Okay. Any rebuttal case?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. We do have some members of the public here that came in after I originally talked. I know you guys are with the unions.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah. Not going to testify today? You, sir? Okay. Then we can move along. I don't think we have any late-filed exhibits.
None by my count.
Yep. Mr. Armstrong?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
Nothing.
Commissioners, was there anything that we were going to follow up on that was asked for?
I have a question regarding exhibits.
Okay.
I look at the exhibit list, and I see 27 NSP exhibits and 8 PSC for a total of 35. And I don't have 35 here, and I'm sure some of them are things that we already have, but...
We've taken out the trade secreted information, so to the extent there was an exhibit with trade secret, you don't have that in your packet.
Those are the... Okay. And I had one question that I had asked...
Yeah,
for an answer on it, and I can't remember what it was right now, but I still want it.
The clean energy, was it the clean energy change in turbines on the siting?
Yeah, on Foxtail.
Yes, yes.
We can certainly provide that in a late filed exhibit.
Okay. There was also at one point a question about the number of jobs created. Was that something that you were looking for?
I found it.
Oh, okay.
On the two North Dakota projects.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I mean, they've already approved the change in turbine.
Right, we'll submit them both.
Closing comments from counsel, Mr. Simpson?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Armstrong?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No.
Okay, let's, how about proposed findings of fact and conclusions? Anything like that? Can we get that in 2 weeks in the late filed exhibits?
Sooner than that.
Okay, so I'll allow up to 2 weeks. Closing remarks from the commissioners. Mr. Crocious.
Thank you for being here. Thank you to staff as well for the hard work you've been putting in or have put in. Mitch, of course. But no, I really appreciate the questions or the answers to the questions that I had and appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Chairman Crisman.
I'll just reiterate that. I appreciate all the work that goes into coming up with a settlement, and I hope when we have a lot of questions or sometimes skepticism about settlements that it doesn't seem insulting, but the settlements are, even if not accepted, an enormous help in trying to frame questions and concerns that I have. So I do appreciate it, and we'll continue to study the evidence.
Mr. Fedorchak.
Thanks, everybody. I think this case is one that's been here a long time. So first of all, I'm going to be pushing to try to wrap this up quickly so that there's a decision and everybody can move forward. Secondly, this also really illustrates the massive amount of changes that are occurring in this industry. And so that leads to a lot of questions and gives us an opportunity to learn from your perspectives, make sure that you're, you know, thinking about all the crazy things that we think about. And sometimes it's good to have a outsider's perspective on stuff that's not quite so technical and allows us to explain this stuff to our constituents as well, so appreciate all of that. But it's an important time because of all the transformation that's occurring that we are diligent in looking at every possible bad outcome so that we aren't missing something that could be out there that could make the case, especially when a case is so obviously positive, it makes you a little suspicious sometimes, like really could it be this good? and what's missing. And I think we have to be really diligent. I hope the companies are doing that as well, being exceptionally diligent in questioning at this time of significant transformation to make sure that we're not missing something and not getting going too far down a path that we're going to regret. And so thanks for your time and attention to all this. I do look forward to more conversations on outside of ADP processes on resource planning and getting a good feel for what's around the corner for Xcel and a good dialogue from our perspective on what is important to us. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioners. Mr. Simpson, I'll just ask you to update the exhibit list with the late-filed exhibit when you file that late-filed exhibit.
No problem at all.
Okay. Thank you very much. So at this time, it's just about 5 to 12. We'll close the hearing on the consolidated hearing on the application of NSP in cases number PU-17-120 and PU-17-372, subject to the filing of the late-filed exhibit. Thanks, everyone. Good job.
Thank you.
Thank you.